I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Health officials in Toronto, Canada, have ordered another 5,000 people into quarantine as the SARS epidemic shows signs of flaring up once again. Some 60 new probable or suspected cases are being reported, only 2 weeks after Toronto officials declared the outbreak under control. Well, joining us from just north of Toronto is Barbara Wall. She's head of the Ontario Nurses Association. She spoke to us in March during Toronto's first SARS outbreak. So welcome back, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Robin.
Well, at that time, you predicted essentially that this would happen, that the outbreak would flare up again. And experts at the Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta as much as accused you of being alarmist. Your thoughts
well,
now?
Actually, I didn't know that. But, you know, there's no question that if you have a communicable disease that isn't cured, that it will come back in some place or other. For the nurses, it was far from over in that they were still treating SARS patients, some of whom were their own nursing colleagues.
What do you think has been done wrong?
We probably minimized it at one point in time. We should have said, okay, let's continue to make sure that everyone is fully protected with masks, gowns, gloves, make sure the public continues to have a high awareness, make sure that particularly in hospital that high alert remains. And we did drop that. The masks came off in most areas. Now, going forward, we think it's critical that masks and gowns and gloves be worn in all areas in acute care.
Well, Dr. Richard Chavis, who's chief of staff at York Central Hospital, told the Washington Post that he agrees with that, but also says that the researchers aren't looking in the right place, that they should be looking more at clusters of pneumonia rather than the individual cases, and at more hospitals than just some hospitals.
Well, you know, you bring up a really good point. We, as nurses, wonder just how much SARS is out there, and it's sort of like a silent SARS. The nurses were saying, look, all these people are atypical. They're not like the normal high-temperature pneumonia-type people we have, and they identified some clusters before they were really made public last week.
Yeah. Do you think that the measures that are being taken now, the quarantine, do you really think they're adequate? We're reading that 1,700 students from Father Michael McGivney Catholic Academy are quarantined. And then there's a liquor store that's been closed because an employee there contracted SARS when he visited a hospital. Do you really think that people are going to stay in the quarantine and not move around?
You know where I think the quarantine has to be more quickly put in place is in the hospitals, and then you won't have this community risk. If in a hospital you have a group of people who show symptoms, quarantine the hospital, because then you don't have any more coming and going. Each of these cases has been someone went into the hospital and someone in the hospital was sick. That student picked it up from his mom. She wasn't wearing protective gear, as far as I know, at least not initially. The liquor store people into the hospital where there should have been a quarantine already.
Right. Well, we read that the epicenter of this current resurgence is a 96-year-old man at North York General Hospital. And he was one of those, as you said, silent carriers. People didn't even realize he had it. He wasn't in the SARS ward.
Exactly. And we're wondering just how many others are like that, which is why we believe it's critical that the nurses be protected and other healthcare workers in those other wards, in orthopedics where he was and other places, and that also visitors be restricted. If they come, they have to wear gloves, gowns, masks.
Yeah. But, Barbara, there's two huge full-page ads in the New York Times today, for instance, advertising that people travel and come and visit Canada. There are people who are worried about symbols of illness, and those gowns and those masks are a symbol. Are you fighting perhaps the leaders of the country and the city who might not want to send out that signal?
Now, there's no way that they can avoid it. The fact is that there is SARS in a number of hospitals. We have hundreds of nurses on quarantine. We have reduced surgeries being done. It's okay to visit Toronto. You know that there is SARS there. You're not going to go to a quarantined hospital because they won't even let you in. But you have to be aware that it is out there. And so there is some risk. It was frustrating for the nurses to hear all of this political push when they were still looking after SARS patients.
Yeah. Well, Barbara, thank you.
Thank you.
Barbara Wall is head of the Ontario Nurses Association. She spoke to us from north of Toronto.
Before President Bush heads to the G8 Economic Summit in France next week, he'll make a stop in St. Petersburg, a city celebrating its 300th anniversary, to meet with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now, the Russian winter may be over, but if Putin's recent meeting with British Prime Minister Tony Blair is any indicator, Bush may still be in for some frost. Putin was icy with Blair on the subject of the war in Iraq, a war overwhelmingly opposed by Russians, which leaves Putin little to lose domestically by taking a hard line again, this time with the U.S. president. He's expected to pose the kind of questions Blair got. Where are the weapons of mass destruction? Why the continuing disarray in Baghdad and beyond? And what about the billions Russia's still owed by Iraq? Well, joining us on the line now from Moscow is Fred Weir, who's reporting on the Bush-Putin meeting for the Christian Science Monitor. Fred, welcome.
Hi.
Fred, President Bush famously said a few years ago that he'd looked Putin in the eye, kind of taken his measure, and concluded the Russian president was a man he could deal with. How's this meeting likely to go?
That sense of friendship trumped all other considerations for him then. What's happened since must have made him feel as though Putin revealed himself not to be a good friend. The row over Iraq, the very hard things that Putin said on behalf of Russia, that the war in Iraq was illegal. He himself didn't call it aggression, but a lot of Russian officials and commentators did. There really was bad blood.
So what are they likely to talk about besides Iraq? Give me kind of bullet points.
The main issue where there will be friction now is Iran. And it seems like a similar case against Iran is unfolding from Washington, that they have weapons of mass destruction, that they're in league with terrorists and so on. And Russia is a close trading partner with Iran. It sells nuclear technology and weapons and so on. So this is what they're more likely to argue about. In general, the war on terror, which seems to have stalled, the whole coalition has unraveled from the Russian point of view, and mainly because of the disputes over Iraq. Trade. Russia really deeply resents the fact that the Jackson-Vanik Amendment is still in force in the United States. It was a law passed a quarter of a century ago, blocking Russian goods from the American market until the Soviet Union let its Jewish population emigrate freely. That's not relevant anymore, but the law is still in force, and this really burns the Russians. Missile defense is another key area where Russia now hopes, after years of opposing the idea, to get into the gravy train, into the technology stream of the missile defense thing, and to have a role to play there. Those kind of forward-looking issues will dominate. They'll only be talking for half an hour, so there wouldn't be time for much.
Right, and that half hour in the sweep of this week-long trip that encompasses France and the Middle East, how important is this visit to Russia?
You know, the fact that Bush is coming at all is the key, because just 2 months ago when they were quarreling so harshly over Iraq, it was a very realistic fear on the Russians' part that Bush might boycott St. Petersburg. And for Putin, this big summit meeting with 50 world leaders and the 300th birthday of St. Petersburg, it's very important for his personal prestige. And Bush could have ruined that. He didn't. He's coming. And that's a very good sign.
Fred Weir, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Fred Weir is reporting on the Bush-Putin summit for the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Moscow. Now, if, as we just heard, the brief summit this weekend in Russia isn't expected to lead to a big breakthrough, hopes are higher for President Bush's planned summit next week in Jordan with Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and Palestinian Prime Minister Mahmoud Abbas. Now, hope, of course, when applied to any effort to reconcile Israelis and Palestinians, can be a risky emotion to indulge in. But the Israeli and Palestinian prime ministers did meet for 2 hours and 45 minutes last night, after which Sharon announced an easing of travel restrictions on Palestinians and possible troop withdrawals from Gaza and the West Bank in return for a Palestinian crackdown on terrorism. And there could be a change soon in the likelihood of terror. The Palestinian prime minister predicted that next week the Islamic radical group Hamas would declare a ceasefire. So should cynics about the peace process lighten up? Joining us to examine that on the line is Molly Moore, Jerusalem bureau chief for The Washington Post. Welcome, Molly.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Molly, Ariel Sharon's, of course, a hardliner, but as you know, this week he used the word occupation for the first time to describe Israel's presence in the disputed territories. That statement, though he arguably pulled back on it a bit soon after, and his conciliatory tone last night, is that posturing to please the U.S., or is something deeper going on here?
Well, it may be a little bit of both. It's a very tenuous situation here. Now, one thing that has changed is both sides are trying to put the best face possible on the meeting with President Bush in Jordan. Now, no one expects any huge breakthroughs here.
Now, of course, the U.S. and European-sponsored roadmap calls for, in its first phase, at the very least, dismantling some sort of far-flung settlements that have been built since March of 2001. Do you think Prime Minister Sharon is capable of that?
He's capable if he wants to. Now, every time the military goes in and tries to dismantle even one of these outposts, there are always major demonstrations and protests between the settlers who are there as well as settlers who come from miles around. But it clearly can be done.
Do you think the government could have the will to do it?
Well, there are so many ifs here. And even though the meeting last night between Abbas and Sharon was positive and everybody came out and used the word positive, people's positions have not changed that dramatically. Ariel Sharon has made the stipulation to the Palestinians that he wants to see serious efforts to stop violence, not just a ceasefire. He wants to see the Palestinians arrest Hamas figures, try them, confiscate weapons. And the Palestinians argue, well, this is quite difficult because over the last 2.5 years, the Israeli military has decimated their security system. They've destroyed almost all their infrastructure, both in the West Bank and Gaza. And although their security officers are allowed on the streets in Gaza, in most cities in the West Bank, they're not. So they're having to rebuild a security service from scratch among people who some of these security officers that we've talked to say, why should we help the Israelis do their job when we have been brutalized by the Israelis for these past several months? So it's very, as always out here, it's very intractable on both sides.
Isn't that kind of the trap door that the Palestinians are in no position to stop terror and the Israelis are in no mood to move forward with a peace process unless terror stops?
Well, that's it. You get stuck in this vicious cycle. But what we are seeing here and what both sides do seem to be making a serious effort to try to take a few steps forward. And the Israelis came out of their meeting last night and said, look, Prime Minister Sharon knows that Abu Mazen, this is the popular name for Mahmoud Abbas, cannot do these things overnight. So the question is, how much patience Ariel Sharon has to allow Abu Mazen to do these things, and also how quickly Abu Mazen can get control over these militant groups.
Molly Moore, thanks so much for joining us on Here and Now.
You're quite welcome.
Molly Moore is the Jerusalem Bureau Chief for The Washington Post.
Just ahead, the man behind, or rather inside, Big Bird.
And later, prosecutorial editing, a tougher approach in newsrooms as heads continue to roll at the New York Times.
There's more coming up here and now.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Partners Healthcare, working with community health centers to provide cancer screenings to uninsured women, 1-800-449-0344. And by the Capital Steps, performing their newest political musical satire at the Copley Theater, June 17th through the 22nd. Tickets on sale now through Ticketmaster and Bostix. 70 degrees right now in Boston. This is WBUR.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Events around the world have you listening to WBUR more than ever before, but bringing you balanced news coverage of global events comes at a significant cost, and it's listener support that makes up the largest share of our funding to pay for the news. When you see our letter in the mail, stop for a moment to think of all the times you've turned to WBUR for your news in the past year. Then please mail the letter in with a contribution. You'll be doing your part to keep the news from WBUR here for you every day.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
For 34 years, an 8-foot-2 big yellow bird has built his nest on Sesame Street.
Well, I'm not all alone. Why, there's Gordon and Susan.
But they're not birds like we are.
I know, but they're nice people.
But you should have a home and a family.
Well, I am home. I like it here on Sesame Street.
When Big Bird was born, Jim Henson's Muppets were already huge stars. When Jim Henson died, it was Big Bird who sang at his funeral. And while Big Bird and his neighbor Oscar the Grouch may not share the same outlook on life, they have the same heart and soul. A guy named Carol Spinney. Let's just say Carol, Big Bird, and Oscar go hand in glove. Carol's new book is called The Wisdom of Big Bird and the Dark Genius of Oscar the Grouch, Lessons from a Life in Feathers. And Carol joins us in the studio. Hello.
Hi there, Robin.
I read in your book that Big Bird started out as kind of a local yokel. And when did he become a child?
Well, it wasn't long that he was a local yokel. Jim Henson had personally discovered me doing my own show called Pickle Puss and Friends. To me, it was like if I was a drummer, he'd say, I've got a little band from Liverpool. Would you like to be me drummer then? And it was Jim Henson asking me. I couldn't believe it. He built the bird around me, and he asked, I asked him, what is he like? And he said, gee, I've been thinking of him as a puppet, but I haven't thought who he's going to be. He said, well, maybe it's like a nice, amiable, goofy guy like Goofy, Mickey Mouse's pal. And we weren't doing the show very long before I said, you know, I think it'd be better if he were a child, because he's trying to learn the alphabet, and he wanted to join a bunch of little kids in a daycare center in one of our scenes. And I said, I don't think you'd want him there as Goofy, but I think he might be there as a child who hasn't learned much yet, even though he's 8 feet, too.
I also just worship Jim Henson, and
his
passing was just horrendous. And so I was devastated to read that he wasn't all that sentimental about
the characters. Well, I'm almost sorry I put it that way, because it sounds like he was cold. There was nothing cold about him. He just was he was a true genius.
But he was surprised that you talked to the puppets,
well, I guess I'm a little silly maybe, but Ernie, he had to drop on the floor because he had a quick change to another puppet. And so Ernie was in his way and he kind of shoved him aside with his foot. And I picked Ernie up and said, gee, Ernie, he didn't mean that. And he said, why, are you sentimental about the puppets? And I said, well, yeah, I guess if the character that you build for them eventually becomes quite real to you.
Yeah. And does that say something about you and what you brought to Big Bird, because you've said that the most important component of Big Bird to you is compassion.
Well, that's what I've kind of developed. First he became the child, and he was kind of sweet and amiable, but and he also was able to get angry and pout and do all the things that kids can do. But one day, actually, I was walking back from Sesame Street, and this little old man, he looked kind of upset, and he was standing there, and I said, is there anything wrong, sir? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I haven't been well, and I'm living alone. And if I fall, there's no one to take care of me. I said, well, would you like to take my arm? And I walked him a few blocks, and he thanked me. The next day, I just couldn't get it out of my mind, and I went to work the next day, and I suggested to one of our producers, couldn't Big Bird do something to teach compassion?
Yeah.
And she said, well, maybe you could just put it into his character. About 3 years later, reading a newspaper telling about the different characters, he said, and then there's the compassionate Big Bird. And I said, yes, success. I must have done something right.
And it is. It's Big Bird that cries with Mr. Snuffleupagus when they have discussion about whether or not they can have imaginary friends, turn out not to be imaginary. And
right. It's
Big Bird that cries when he learns that Mr. Hooper has died, and all the children watching learn. I'm getting a little choked up when I talk about it. You know, so it's Big Bird that brought those moments to us.
Yes, and it was that was what I realized. I'd gone a long way from just being, you know, I was Grandma Nellie the clown on Bozo Show.
Well, you know, it's the most amazing thing. Everywhere Big Bird is, you are. It's just the weirdest thing. And so I'm wondering, is Big Bird here now?
I'll see. Big Bird?
What is it?
Come here a minute.
Oh, hi. Who's this?
Hi, Big Bird. It's Robin.
Oh, hello, Robin. You don't look like a bird.
That's right. You're the bird. You're a big bird. How old are you?
Well, I'm 6 now.
Ah.
Bird years, though.
Oh.
Not quite the same as yours.
No. Well, Big Bird, I know you've been doing a lot of interviews along with your friend.
Mm-hmm.
Big Bird, what's the silliest thing people are asking you? Because people can ask the silliest things.
Well, this morning, somebody asked me all about what's my opinion about dating.
Oh.
I didn't know what that word means.
When they tell you about the birds and the... Oh, wait, you already know about the birds.
Yeah, I'm one of them. Oscar, get out of the... He's in your wastebasket.
Oh,
Oscar.
No.
Hey, Hey, look, I'm looking for good stuff in here. I love trash.
Hi, Oscar.
We all know that, Oscar.
Oscar, you know what I want to know? Oscar, are you really as grouchy as people say?
I'm a little grouchier than that. Particularly today, I got up on the right side of the bed. Oh. I hate that.
Yeah. Big Bird, how do you... You know, Oscar sometimes can be so grouchy, and, you know, he's making a mess right now in our garbage can.
Oscar, you're making a mess.
Good. How do you feel about that, Big Bird? Sometimes he's kind of rude.
Yeah, but he's nice. I kind of like most people. He just pulls lots of tricks on me. And he also calls me an overgrown bag of giblets. Hey, I'm glad to make you unhappy. Oscar, you want to make him unhappy? Well, not exactly. I like to frustrate the turkey. I'm not a turkey!
Okay, all right. No, we're not going to fight. Do you find yourself talking to Big Bird and Oscar a lot?
Yeah, I often feel that Big Bird is sort of like a little boy to me. I'm glad to know him. Mm. And he's not me, but yet I seem to feel I know him very well, and I have a very fatherly feeling towards him.
Yeah.
Me too? No, not you.
Well, we want to thank you for bringing him and Oscar to us. I mean, you know, it's funny. Some people have their inner child, and Big Bird and Oscar have their inner adult.
Yeah, I guess they do.
That's you. Thank you.
Well, it's nice to be here.
Bye.
Bye.
Have a rotten day.
Carol Spinney, author of the new book, The Wisdom of Big Bird and the Dark Genius of Oscar the Grouch, Lessons from a Life in Feathers.
Well, next time on Here and Now, our Washington Roundtable considers President Bush's agenda overseas. Is the president ready for an unfamiliar role as an international statesman?
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Skinner Auctioneers, hosting an auction of antique American furniture, folk art, and paintings Sunday, June 8th at 11 a.m. in Boston. Preview begins on June 4th. Details and catalog at SkinnerInc.com. By J. Miles, a neighborhood boutique dedicated to serving a community of women interested in a personalized approach to shopping on Huron Ave in Cambridge. J. Miles, distinctive dressing for discerning women. And by Mississippi's. Mississippi serves 500 to 1,500 people every day. You can learn more about our next Citizens of the World tour to Tuscany and Umbria at a free reception on Monday, June 9th. To reserve your space, call 800-909-9287. Later this hour in Here and Now, a review of the documentary film A Decade Under the Influence. This is WBUR.
NPR's Sylvia Poggioli.
Kosovo Albanians, the overwhelming majority of the population, are impatiently demanding independence. The dwindling number of Serbs, strongly supported by Belgrade, insist Kosovo must remain part of Serbia.
Meet Sylvia Poggioli and ask her your questions about the Balkans and other major stories she's covered this Sunday at a brunch hosted by Tom Ashbrook. For tickets to benefit WBUR, call 800-909-9287.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, proudly supporting public radio and serving the community, on the web at MathWorks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, our editorial roundtable looks at turmoil at the New York Times.
We see a roiling, fractious newsroom where people are angry at each other, they're angry at leadership, they're turning on each other publicly.
And a new documentary takes audiences back to the movies that made the late 60s and early 70s great years for American cinema, with flicks like Chinatown, Easy Rider, and of course, The Godfather.
You spend time with your family?
Sure I do.
Good. Because a man who doesn't spend time with his family can never be a real man.
These stories coming up Here and Now.
I'm Marianne Nichols. President Bush is on his way to Europe and then the Middle East on his first major trip abroad since the end of the war in Iraq. The Mideast leg of the journey marks Bush's deepest involvement in Israeli-Palestinian peacemaking. He says he's intent on working out a peaceful two-state solution. As he left, the president called on Israel's neighbors to ensure the safety of Israel and warned Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan that funding of terrorist groups could topple the peace process. The president first stops in Europe, where he'll visit Poland, Russia, and France. In a brief visit to Poland, British Prime Minister Tony Blair says he has absolutely no doubt that evidence of Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction will yet be found in Iraq. Blair, who is under fire by critics in Britain who say he exaggerated the threat posed by Iraq before the war, urged critics to have a little patience.
The idea that we authorized or made our intelligence agencies invent some piece of evidence is completely absurd.
In an interview in the upcoming issue of Vanity Fair magazine, U.S. Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz downplayed Iraq's alleged weapons program as a reason for war, instead citing Washington's desire to withdraw troops from Saudi Arabia. Meantime, Israeli and Palestinian officials are reportedly working on one of the first elements of the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. The agreement is supposed to include statements from each side recognizing the rights of statehood and security to the other. A top Palestinian official says a joint panel is meeting today to iron out the final wording for the statements. Federal officials are reviewing the latest intelligence on terror threats and say they may lower the nation's terror alert level to yellow from the current orange level. Yellow is the middle level on the 5-stage alert scale. The alert has been at orange for high since terrorist attacks earlier this month in Saudi Arabia and Morocco. A chapter in aviation history is about to close with the last flight of Air France's Concorde. The supersonic jet left De Gaulle Airport this morning for New York. It returns to Paris tomorrow for the last time. British Airways will retire its Concorde fleet in October. The jet's expensive maintenance and fears of flying since 9/11 are cited as the reasons. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 124 points at 8835, and the Nasdaq is up 17 points at 1592. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Anderson McQuaid, specializing in custom and stock architectural hardwood moldings and flooring in domestic and exotic hardwoods, in Cambridge or at AndersonMcQuaid.com. By Caritas St. Elizabeth's Medical Center, an academic affiliate of Tufts Medical School and member of the Caritas Christi Healthcare. Information on their physicians and programs available at SEMC.org. And by TechFusion.com, 24/7 data recovery specialists. TechFusion helps prevent data disasters from happening now and in the future. TechFusion, where data is never lost. In the forecast, a mix of clouds and sun today, a chance of an afternoon shower, highs in the mid-70s. Tomorrow, some sun in the morning, but showers likely tomorrow afternoon through the weekend. 70 degrees right now. In sports, the Red Sox open a 3-game series tonight in Toronto. This is WBUR.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Let me be clear. The following introduction was written by myself with an assist from producer Emiko Tamagawa and editor Kathleen McKenna. Executive producer Mark Navin might have added a thought or two as well. There. On Wednesday, New York Times writer Rick Bragg resigned from the paper after acknowledging that he did not do the above, that he didn't credit stringers, interns, news writers, and others who contributed to his articles. In the weeks since the Times revealed that Jason Blair had fabricated and plagiarized dozens of reports, the Times newsroom has erupted in finger-pointing and recriminations, and the reverberations are being felt at news organizations across the country. But is the Times going through soul-searching or scapegoating? Joining us on the line from Yakima, Washington, is Sarah Jenkins, editor of the Yakima Herald Republic. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Robin.
And we're joined this week by Boston Globe media critic Mark Jerkowitz. Mark, nice to talk to you again.
Hi, Robin.
And let's start with you. Rick Bragg of the Times said he did what many reporters do in using stringers and people that he paid, actually had paid intern, to collect information for him. So is that common?
I don't know. You're going to have to talk to my stringer who takes all my phone calls, does all my work for me. No, it's not common in any other newspaper. There are obviously, there can be correspondents, there can be interns. but it's very rare, essentially, for someone to almost have their own reporter assigned to them in the way in television sometimes that you have kind of the producer and then the on-air talent. And it seems to also be fairly rare at the New York Times as well because candidly, there are a lot of people inside that newsroom who are angry at the apparent relationship between Bragg and his helpers.
Right. Sarah, it seems to me that sometimes I will see that kind of assist mentioned in the byline. You know, you'll see a list of names, especially during the Iraqi War, for instance.
Right.
You'll see a list of names, and then it'll say written by. And that will be, for instance, a Rick Bragg. So we hear that these assistants are called legs and that they're in every newsroom. Are they in yours?
Boy, if they are, they're invisible. Mm. The issue here is that he didn't give them credit. You know, to go into a small community and, you know, work with somebody to get background, that's understandable. But then you give that person credit.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be honest with your readers about where the information's coming from.
Right. In Bragg's defense, Howard Kurtz in the Post points out that Rick Bragg suffers from severe diabetes, and that's one of the reasons he can't do a lot of walking. But I guess it does come to the credit. But also at the Times, there's the Judith Miller, John Burns dust-up. Mark, you're aware of this. She's the Times reporter who's an expert in germ warfare. John Burns is the Times bureau chief in Baghdad. And emails between the two were printed also by Howard Kurtz in the Washington Post. They were having a spat over what?
Well, they're apparently having a spat over the sourcing of some of Judith Miller's stories coming out of Iraq, some of her stories about the weapons of mass destruction, her reliance on members of the Iraqi opposition. It's so inside that nobody other than people inside our business themselves care about the issue per se. But I think what's happened here in the wake of the Jason Blair scandal to the New York Times, now followed by the Rick Bragg case, now followed by some attention to Judith Miller and email surfacing in the newsroom, is that almost like in The Wizard of Oz, suddenly the curtain has come up inside the most prestigious newspaper in America, and we see a roiling, fractious newsroom where people are angry at each other, they're angry at leadership, they're turning on each other publicly. And frankly, I think the bigger implications of this dust-up and the others are you wonder – I think legitimately at this point about the futures of the top editors there and the brass there, because we're really getting a look at a very unstable and unhappy newsroom at this point.
But Sarah, as you who head up a newsroom, I mean, isn't this potentially in the long run a good thing? You know, this sort of transparency and cleansing. And what's happening in your newsroom?
Well, I think in the big picture, it is a good thing, because it's allowing us within the newsroom to talk about these issues, to talk about what exactly is the definition of plagiarism, for example. And we had a staff meeting on Wednesday in which that was the topic. But the other part of it is, in addition to us talking about it in-house, which is terribly important, it also gives us the opportunity to talk to our readers about it and to talk about where we do get our information and how they can look to us to figure this out.
Yeah. Well, Mark, this kind of heavy vetting, the phrase I'm hearing is prosecutorial editing?
I take the fifth. I think we are getting, because this happened at the New York Times, and nobody else can sit there and say, well, we have better standards than them necessarily. I think everybody in this business is reevaluating their standards. There are newspapers getting ready to send out form letters to people who have been written about, essentially saying, were you covered accurately and were you covered fairly? I think the industry right now is looking at itself very closely. I think there's a focus on two things. One, better newsroom communication, so that people who think there are problems in the newsroom, as there were with Jason Blair, can feel comfortable talking to editors. The other piece of it is I think editors, there's a real sense that editors need to be much more vigilant with what the reporters are doing, talk to reporters about anonymous sources, ask harder questions, not simply push copy through. And yes, two people I talked to this week mentioned the term prosecutorial editing, which sounds scary and hopefully will help clean up the business a little bit.
By the way, we should mention that your paper, The Globe, is owned by the New York Times, so I guess
Correct.
There's some real soul-searching going on there. Overall,
and also Jason Blair worked at the paper.
Yep. But, Sarah, how about yourself? Do you find, I mean, you write, do you find yourself second-guessing yourself?
I do. And one of the things that's come up in the discussion is the Internet, and I just wanted to mention that. because it's gotten so easy to find other things. But the truth is, it's still stealing.
Right. And it
doesn't matter if it's easy or hard.
And it used to be hard to report something if you weren't there, and now you can go there on the Internet.
Right.
Well, Mark, what's going on here? From Mike Barnicle at Your Paper, alleged to have fabricated Patricia Smith, Stephen Glass, making up entire stories, Jason Blair. The New York Post, a tabloid, just fired a reporter who lifted an entire article from the National Enquirer. Is there some overarching thing going on here?
I'd say two things. One, when you have scandals like this in journalism, it's almost like a viral outbreak because all of a sudden every newsroom starts to look much more closely at what they're doing. You will almost always find two or three similar cases surfacing almost at the same time. But I'll leave this with an optimistic note in a normally cynical profession. I also think one of the things we have now is quote-unquote better law enforcement. The whole idea of the media looking at the media, which often seems a little insidery, is really a relatively new development in this business. And what could have been brushed under the table or hidden or not dealt with, it now goes public so quickly within the industry that I'm not sure that the standards are worse or that the behavior of journalists are worse these days. I just think they're getting caught much more often.
Yeah. Well, I mean, with all of this navel-gazing, maybe we'll finally find out who Deep Throat is. Or maybe not. Well, I want to thank you both.
My pleasure.
It's been fun.
Sarah Jenkins, editor of the Yakima Herald Republican, Yakima, Washington, and Mark Cherkowitz, media critic for the Boston Globe in Boston, Massachusetts.
Well, still to come, forget it, Jake, it's Chinatown. I know it was you, Fredo. Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Great lines from groundbreaking films of the late 60s and early 70s recalled in the new documentary, A Decade Under the Influence.
You're listening to Here and Now. The nation is under attack. Simultaneous terrorist strikes have paralyzed New York City and the Capitol. But the president of the United States remains cool, decisive, even heroic. Well, in the movies, anyway. And this account of September 11th is coming soon to a television near you. But this isn't any ordinary potboiler. This is a movie made by a White House insider and approved by first friend Karl Rove. It's cinema, all right, but some have questioned its verite. Doug Saunders is international affairs correspondent for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper. He's in Toronto, where DC 9/11 is being filmed. He's seen the script. So, Doug, tell us, who plays George Bush, and how is he presented in those times?
George Bush will be played by an actor named Timothy Bottoms, who some of you may know for his portrayal of George W. Bush in a comedy series called That's My Bush. That was an over-the-top satire created by the guys who made South Park. Now he's playing it straight in what is a very straight depiction of the President's Day on September 11th and the days following. There are several people attempting to make films about this period, but this one has a lot of access to the White House in its creation and also is created by people who are very loyal to the Bush administration.
Well, tell us about that. Who created it and where's that access?
This is a guy named Lionel Chetwynd, who's a pretty well-known figure in Hollywood, partly because he has a really good track record. He wrote the TV movie Kissinger and Nixon, which was quite a good little movie. But he's also known as kind of the lone Republican in Hollywood. He's the founder of the Wednesday Morning Club, which is the Republican club for that small group. And he was the guy who led the efforts to bring the White House and the creative community in Hollywood together after September 11th.
In fact, you report that he asked Karl Rove directly if he could get in front of the line for those clamoring to tell the story.
He told me Karl Rove was in Hollywood. And he said, you know, can you help me with this? And it was a very cooperative thing. It's funny because for a lot of the last 10 years, a lot of figures in Hollywood were very close with the Democratic administration in Washington. You know, guys like the Baldwin brothers. Mm. Mind you, none of them actually got to make a movie about Clinton while he was sitting in the White House, did they?
No, they didn't.
So I think that's what's fresh.
So let's compare this movie with firsthand journalistic accounts of 9/11. Bob Woodward's comes to mind. How does this film jive with those reports?
A lot of it is very much like the Bob Woodward account, it must be said. But the president comes off at least from reading the script. I mean, this could be different when it's filmed. He comes off a bit as a John Wayne character who seizes the day right from the beginning. Some other journalistic accounts have presented him as wavering a lot more. Mm. He certainly gives much more appealing, lengthy speeches than other accounts have him doing.
There's one line, "If some tinhorn terrorist wants me, tell him to come and get me. I'll be at home waiting for the bastard." This is supposed to be a president aboard Air Force One trying to get back to Washington, D.C. How does that jive with reality?
The word tinhorn does come up in the Bob Woodward account, although the line is not so much him shouting down the Secret Service agent, which they have in the movie, as it is sort of a complaint. And other accounts have had him waver a lot more. Now, given that Mr. Chetwynd had access to top White House people, this may be how they now describe the event. It does present him as a lot more determined, though.
Hmm. Doug, thank you.
Thank you.
Doug Saunders is with the Globe and Mail newspaper in Toronto. And here is Timothy Bottoms the last time he played President George W. Bush.
Hey, you guys, listen up. Someday I'm going to be president of the United States.
Yeah. Yeah.
When I am, you can all come and stay at the White House as long as you want. Hey, wait a minute. Where's my pants?
Stay with us. There's more ahead here and now.
From Boston University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Dover Rug Company. Classic, contemporary, eclectic rugs and carpeting for today's lifestyle. Dover Rug Company, Natick and Hanover. And on the web at doverrug.com or 800-DOVER-RUG. By David L. Babson & Company, investment advisors to private clients and institutions, working to help clients build and preserve wealth since 1940. David L. Babson in Cambridge and on the web at dlbabson.com. And the Boston Bean Coffee Company, purveyors of fine coffee, equipment, and service to the workplace, and exclusive distributor of Pete's Coffee and Teas. Information at 1-800-448-BREW. This is the last day to enter our drawing to win the latest model from Subaru, a new Baja, courtesy of Cityside Subaru in Arlington. See the new Baja and enter the drawing before tonight's deadline at WBUR.org. 72 degrees now. This is WBUR.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
In the late 60s and 70s, it seemed like most every movie that came out changed movies. New ways of seeing the country, the world, new and revolutionary ways to create cinema. Then new names ignited their still enduring careers. Martin Scorsese, Jack Nicholson, Francis Ford Coppola, Dennis Hopper, Dustin Hoffman, Donald Sutherland, and I could go on for quite a while.
He must be some important dude, man, like, you know, that treatment.
A dude? What does he mean, dude? Dude ranch? Dude?
No. Dude means nice guy.
Godfather, I don't know what to do.
You can act like a man! What's the matter with you? Is this how you turn down a Hollywood Pinocchio that cries like a woman?
To you, Mrs. Mulray. Frankly, tonight you saved my... neck.
Movies like Chinatown, Easy Rider, and The Godfather were grittier and more realistic than Hollywood's standard fare and pulled off the trifecta of winning over cynical audiences, high-minded critics, and money-hungry studio executives alike. Well, now the maverick spirit of that era has been captured in a new independent film channel documentary, A Decade Under the Influence, which is in theaters now and will be shown on IFC in August. Here and Now's film reviewers, Eric Schaefer and Renee Graham, are in the studio to tell us what they thought of the film. Hello, guys.
Hi, Bill.
Well, Renee, before we get to the documentary, which was directed by screenwriter Richard LeGravenez and the late Ted Demme, why don't you explain what the 70s meant to you for filmmaking and for watching movies?
I was a kid in the 70s, but my family, my parents were big film buffs, so they were always taking my sister and I to go see films. I saw, you know, The Godfather when I was 9 years old. I saw Godfather 2 a few years later because my parents just would take us to see everything. But the 70s also for me in my neighborhood where I grew up in New York were about the so-called blaxploitation films. That's what everybody went to go see. Shaft, Superfly, Coffee, Foxy Brown. Those films aren't really represented, though, in this documentary, which is disappointing.
Eric, what is represented in this movie?
the top of the line, the guys who you think of over and over and over again, the Coppolas, the Altmans, people like Paul Mazursky and Sidney Lumet and so on, sort of the establishment in many respects.
This was revolutionary stuff, though. You guys sound, Renee, like right off the bat, you're not that impressed with this movie.
I wasn't. I mean, you know, you can certainly enjoy seeing the film clips. You see clips from Harold and Maud and Chinatown and Network and The Godfather, and there's always a lot to be gained from that. But there's not a lot of context for these films, other than the fact that there's a bunch of talking heads saying, boy, weren't we great and weren't we revolutionary and edgy and look at the films we did. And, you know, a lot of these were still big studio films like The Godfather. Yeah. So it's very self-congratulatory.
Yeah, I think that's probably the most disconcerting thing about this movie is just the sense that these people are all really reaching around, you know, doing these contortions to pat themselves on the back. And there's not a whole lot of balance in this movie. As Renee indicated, there's really virtually nothing in this film about blaxploitation. Blaxploitation initially was really started by the big studios, but then it had a real life of its own with the smaller studios, the independents. And so that whole sort of exploitation end of things is completely wiped out from this account of the 1960s and 70s. And that's where a lot of this stuff really sort of bubbled up from initially.
The omission almost seems to imply that those films weren't important. But I beg to differ. You know, what's considered the first blaxploitation film is a Melvin Van Peebles 1971 film, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. And, you know, it's very cheaply made. The studios wouldn't finance it. The financing actually came from Bill Cosby for the film. And it's an inarticulate film, but a film that perfectly articulated the rage and frustration of Black America. And if this documentary is supposed to be about how the social upheavals of the 60s inform the filmmaking of the 1970s, and I don't know of many films that did it as well as Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song.
Where's Sweetback? Where is he?
Where is he? Sweetback?
I don't know where Sweetback.
Where's Sweetback?
Come on, boy! Where
is he? I don't know where Sweetback is.
Come on, boy, talk!
Where's Sweetback?
Where Sweetback is.
Come on, boy.
Where's Sweetback?
Now, this is the first of three parts, so maybe some of these errors will be corrected in the future. But, you know, guys, I'm wondering, we've got to be careful, a little careful here, that we're not jaded, perhaps. I mean, you think of what came right before these films. We weren't too far off from the Doris Day era. These were still revolutionary films, no?
These films were doing things differently, and you certainly can't take away from the films themselves. I think we can, though, you know, have some quibbles with the way in which the documentary presents this material. One of the big things that, you know, is really missing in this film, maybe it'll turn up in the second or the third film, is the way in which exhibition was changing at the time, the way in which distribution was changing at the time. None of that is dealt with at all.
Something I was just thinking about as Eric was speaking is, in addition to sort of them congratulating themselves, then they, towards the end of the film, they look at how, you know, the big films like Jaws and Star Wars were just a stake through the heart of what they were trying to do, and how, you know, Star Wars, bad, Chinatown, good. You know, it's a little simplistic in that way. It's taking nothing away from the films themselves. Chinatown, these are amazing films that they're talking about, but again, there's no context.
The one thing that I think would have helped this film immensely is if they would have had some historians, some social critics, somebody else to add a little balance to help to show, you know, what the period was about, what was really happening. Now, that's not to say that this is an awful film. I mean, it's a very sort of friendly, very sort of, you know, it's like a bunch of guys getting together in their neighborhood. And it is basically guys. You know, there are only about three or four women in the whole film.
It's basically white guys.
Right, exactly. You know, they're I think Pam Grier is the only person of color in the movie. So it's really, you know, a bunch of guys sitting around in a bar are kind of talking about the good old days.
You guys really hated this film.
No.
What just, am I missing
it's,
here?
It's a great movie if you are not familiar with this period at all, or if you only know The Godfather, if that's the only movie you've ever watched prior to 1975 or something. This is a good movie to see because you'll at least sort of get an introduction to some of the filmmakers and some of the films that made this, you know, period so interesting.
I mean,
important.
Some of the films you must revere, Eric.
Oh,
absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that it's so nice to see a movie like The King of Marvin Gardens being talked about, a movie that, you know, hardly ever gets discussed anymore. You know, it's nice to see at least a brief tip of the hat to The Conversation, which, for my money, is still Francis Ford Coppola's best film. It's great movie with Gene Hackman as a wiretap expert.
You should have seen it, though. These new microphones are just incredible. They really, I couldn't hardly believe it myself. We were over 200 yards away. It was absolutely readable. I broke in a couple of newsreel cameramen. And you should have been there, Bernie. It was really...
What did they do?
Well, they took the crosshairs of the telescope and they lined it up on the mouths.
No, the boy and the girl. What did they do?
Oh, I don't know. But it was really beautiful.
But there are so many movies that are sort of ignored or they're glossed over, and that's really unfortunate.
Name one that was ignored or glossed over, both of you.
Sweet, Sweetback's
you
badass.
You said that already.
That just
yeah, and that is a great film.
That really does bother me because it, you know, they talk about civil rights and then don't show any movies reacting to what happened in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, I mean, there were these interesting movies being made by women, primarily for Roger Corman. They were essentially exploitation movies made by women like Stephanie Rothman and Barbara Peters. And, you know, these were some of the only women working at the time. They're completely ignored.
So, to conclude, we're far from saying that the movies of this great period were bad movies by any means. They were some fantastic movies. You just didn't like this documentary about that period.
That's right. I think that, you know, the documentary really doesn't do enough service to this period. People are probably much better off going out and renting some movies from the era that they haven't seen. Catch up on The Conversation or Nashville or
Network.
Little Big Man, Network.
Yeah. Harold and Maude, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon.
Great period, disappointing documentary.
Right. Renee and Eric, thanks a lot, guys, for coming in.
Thanks, Bill.
We've been talking about the new documentary about filmmaking in the late 60s and early 70s, A Decade Under the Influence. Eric Schaefer is a film historian who teaches at Emerson College, and Renee Graham is pop culture correspondent for the Boston Globe.
Who's the black private dick that's a sex machine to all the chicks? You're damn right. Who is the man that would risk his neck for his brother, man?
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna, and our editor is Mitch Wortlieb. Special thanks this week to Emiko Tomogawa.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Tim Skog and Boris Strapatsky. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our interns are Lindsay Crudell and Marisa Francini.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
Have a great weekend and join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. Information on the web at MathWorks. Information on the web at MathWorks.